Performing a memory. Let's start with the experience of a memory, specifically an episodic memory, a scene from your life that can be remembered with the faint glimmer of something like re-experiencing the event. Let's go back to this morning, the moments between waking up and getting out of bed. Shut your eyes and try to enter that space. First, what are the concrete details? Did you wake up by yourself or with an alarm? Was there someone in the bed with you? How long did it take you to get up? Now the phenomenological. What did the sheets feel like? Were you groggy or alert? Did you remember your dreams? What was the quality of the light in the room? What was the temperature of the air on your skin? From the perspective of cognitive neuroscience, we know a fair amount about the biological processes at work when we generate memory and other thoughts, but a little about how these processes actually produce the subjective experience of thinking and remembering. The neuroscientist David Marr described this as, quote, trying to understand bird flight by studying only feathers. It just cannot be done, unquote. We know that thought requires the firing of neurons, that they set each other off in chains of action and inhibition, depending on the chemicals they pass to each other. We can observe synchronizing patterns of neuronal firing and the changes to the electromagnetic field at the scalp and the location of activity by tracking the changes in blood flow through fMRI. But as for how this electrical and chemical activity constitutes a thought, it's flight and we are still amongst the feathers. While it's easy to imagine transient thoughts that come and go as shifting patterns of activation, what about the thoughts that are able to be repeated in some way? What about memory? Early studies searched for the location of an n-gram, a functional unit of information thought to be stored in a discrete location in the brain, as if it were a filing cabinet or a hard drive. Researchers trained rats in mazes and then removed parts of their cortex, trying to find the key location without which the rats would forget how to run the maze. What they found, however, was that the memory was affected not by where the cortex was removed, but by how much. The greater the volume removed, no matter where from, the worse the rats performed in the maze. This led to the conclusion that the trace of any one memory, rather than being localized, is distributed throughout the brain, encoded in the changing strengths of the relationships between networks of neurons. At the algorithmic level, details of episodic memories are bound together within a cognitive diagram of their associations, called event models. The act of recalling these memories triggers a reperformance of the models that were active at the time of encoding, i.e. a restaging of the gestures and patterns that were active in processing the original experience. For example, one study using fMRI to track the location of activation in the brain had participants watch a film and then later recount its plot. They found that the pattern of activation as participants encoded each distinct scene was so similar to the pattern when they later narrated it that the part of the story being recounted could be predicted from the signature of activation alone. Beyond this, they ran fresh participants who listened to this narrated version of the film, and their pattern of activation was again so similar that the individual scenes of the film could be distinguished. What this means is that not only does remembering constitute a restaging of the original pattern, like a script for a performance, but our communication to others through language also acts like a transmission of the script. Look at the room around you. try to catalogue as much detail about the objects you can see in the spaces between them. Below the level of explicit perception, you are building a cognitive model of these relations. Look at the object which you're accessing this text from, whether it be paper, a phone, a laptop. If you're listening to the audiobook, move the object transmitting it so that it's within your reach. Next, close your eyes and try to hold the model you've built in your mind's eye. Keeping your eyes closed, reach out and touch the top left corner of your reading device. How accurate were you? Try this gesture again. Did you improve the second time? The process of building an event model is much like building a spatial model of the world, in that both involve binding of individual elements and the relations between them. These models are not discrete and faithful records, but rather they shape and are shaped by event schema, generalized models of how we expect events to go based on previous experience. Our experience of life is mediated by the many overlapping schema in which we maintain the relations between space, objects, other people, and ourselves. If cognition occurs as a pattern of activation, then we can picture it as gestural and performative. And if the act of remembering is the re-performance of a previous gesture, then we can think of memory as a biologically encoded script for such a performance. If we view memory in this way, then we can apply theoretical frameworks that have been built around performativity within other fields, such as performance art, a discipline which has meditated at length on the nature of bodies and space and in relation to each other. What does it mean to be performative? The trajectory of performance art that emerged in New York in the 1960s centered itself around the question of what performance is and does. First, performativity is not a quality that separates art from ordinary life, but rather is inherent in both. For example, the dancer Yvonne Rainer in works like The Mind is a Muscle from 1968, aptly titled for our conversation here, used choreography derived from pedestrian movements, in both senses of the word, ordinary, as well as literally mirroring the bustle and unchoreographed coordination of pedestrians on the street. Performers, together and individually, were instructed to move with a, quote, task or work-like movement with a factual quality, unquote, collaboratively building the work in their actions. For example, in Stairs, quote, Steve handstand, David grabs his legs while Y gets foam. Place. Rolls down. D and S come front. Push mat as D and S rejoin Y. Breast hold while she alone walks up and jumps. Unquote. For the feminist critic Amelia Jones, the use of the body as an art object constituted a, quote, dislocation or decentering of the Cartesian subject of modernism. Unquote. A subject structured by clear demarcations between mind/body and self/other, by making visible the intersubjectivity between artist, art object, and viewer that is inherent within every encounter with art. Other artists, instead of inserting ordinary life into the realm of art, inserted art into the realm of ordinary life. Adrienne Piper, for example, who stuffed a towel in her mouth and rode the subway and toured galleries with a handbag full of ketchup, violated the norms which ensure the smooth functioning of pedestrian life in order to upset her own visible invisibility as a white passing black woman. Using the body directly in the work brought with it all the messy specificities and context of the subject, as well as highlighting their position within matrices of power, aspects which modernist formalism sought to suppress. If we think of our own cognition in the same way, a lens of performativity allows us to frame it as embedded not only within the body as an evasion of Cartesian dualism, but also within social contexts shot through with racialized, gendered, and economic inequalities. And remember that both these contexts of the body and the body politic are in turn represented cognitively as schema, and as such are cognitively performed in ways which shape our behavior and thus our own influence back onto these contexts. A performative perspective on cognition can especially help us to understand what it means for cognition to be constructed in action. In defining performativity, Judith Butler quotes Nietzsche's assertion that the doer is constituted by the deed, and applies this to her own argument about gender, in that gender identity is not essential, but rather something that is constituted by its own performance. Likewise, we could say that a memory is not a stable entity, remember the engram, but rather it is, quote, performatively constituted by the very expressions that are said to be its results, unquote. For the critic Peggy Phelan, performance art is a gesture in line with the linguist J.L. Austin's distinction between constitutive utterances, acts of speech that merely describe external reference in the world, and performative utterances, which are actions in and of themselves. Crucially, Austin's performative utterances are not subject to any binary positivism of being true or false. Recall the choreography of Rainer's Stairs. The performers move with a busy orderliness as they approach their tasks, which independently constitute small units of meaning, a jump, a somersault, a handstand, the execution of which depends on collaboration of the performers, which can be reconfigured endlessly and can repeat the same units of movement which only exist in their moment of execution and, even if repeated, are unique in every iteration. In this framework, thought is not abstract representation, but something as physical as a somersault. Shut your eyes again. Try to remember the gesture of reaching out in the dark. Don't physically move, but picture it as clearly as you can. Picture the trajectory of your reach, the pressure of contact on your hand. While you may not outwardly be repeating the movement, internally, your neurons are shadowing the earlier pattern of activation in order to simulate this previous experience. What does it mean for cognition to be performative? As with Jones's assertion, the major advantage of thinking of cognition as performative is that this position evades Cartesian dualism, which conceives of mind and body as separate, and which imagines subjects as able to function as rational observers divorced from corporeal reality. Despite this totalizing framework supposedly having been unraveled by post-structuralism, it has tended to linger and mutate rather than to die. In the field of cognitive science, Alan Jasanoff has argued that while we have ostensibly moved beyond the idea of a Cartesian subject and accepted that the mind emerges from the biological functions of the brain, the spirit of dualism persists by drawing a distinction between the brain and the rest of the body, mystifying the brain and its behavior. Beyond this, the hangover of Cartesian dualism, combined with 20th century cybernetics, has led to a tendency within cognitive science to view the brain as a disembodied computing organism, which receives input stimuli, performs a computation using abstract symbols, cognition, and generates outputs, action. In this model, information travels in a single direction, with no feedback between the levels, and with cognition happening within the sealed system of the brain. This framework has not gone unchallenged. In fact, as far back as 1916, the psychologist Margaret Floyd Washburn proposed the inextricability of bodily movement from mental life. More recently, there have emerged challenges that insist that cognition is inherently embodied as a routine bodily function, inactive, being constituted in action, as well as embedded in the wider physical and social context that the body inhabits, and as such, constituted in relation to others. These elements have all been played out and become well established in the trajectory of performance art, However, their emergence in the field of cognitive science has by no means become the dominant perspective, and often derided as an unscientifically vague fad. Remember, it doesn't last. Beyond locating thought and memory as embodied / inactive / embedded, a performative lens on cognition allows us to see that it also shares what, for Phelan, is the greatest strength of performance: its transience. For Phelan, the impermanence and unreproducible quality of performance means that it, quote, clogs the smooth machinery of reproductive representation necessary to the circulation of capital, unquote. This is again pertinent as the current resurgence of dualism comes in the form of transhumanist promises of radical life extension through uploading or technologically externalizing consciousness into a more permanent form, in what theorist Rossi Braidotti calls, quote, the transhumanist fantasy of escape from the finite materiality of the enfleshed self, unquote. The futility of technologically transcribing thought into some stable medium is the same futility that Phelan ascribes to attempts at performance documentation. For Phelan, writing especially relies on reproduction of the same, while at an ontological level performance is non-reproductive. Resisting reproducibility is for Phelan a strategy for resisting capitalist economies, which is why she advocates for resisting documentation. If we write a memory or thought, at best we can create a script for the reperformance in the minds of others or for ourselves. But as Phelan cautions, reperformances are only ever iterative, not replicative. Each restaging is unique in and of itself. Memory, our original attempt at transcribing the gestures that have constituted our lives, is fallible, itself just another performance that happens in an instant and then falls into nothing. Memory, our original attempt at transcribing the gestures that have constituted our lives, is fallible, itself just another performance that happens in an instant and then falls into nothing. The void of the past into which all things fall is the enduring reality that transhumanists try to scramble away from when they propose transcription of thought, memory, and consciousness itself into digital forms. Acceptance of the void, of the fleeting nature of all things, is for Phelan an evasion of the reproductive demands of capital, an escape hatch from its demands of permanence and profitable exchange.